Set? Ready? Welcome, everybody, to the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. For the record, it's May 1st, 2017.
That was kind of squeaky.
What?
Nothing.
All right, you. Patrick, first up, I think we have the University of Oregon presentation.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we're going to have a presentation from the University of Oregon on their campus for accelerated scientific impact, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Ducks.
Thank you. We have a presentation, so we just want to make sure we have it.
Yeah, it'll come up when she pushes the button right there. There we go.
Ducks with beakers and test tubes.
Well, thank you very much, Chairman Beyer and other members of the committee. We're very happy to be here. What we wanted to do is come here today and tell you about this great new effort that we have going on at the University of Oregon. In October, we announced a new $1 billion program to expand our capacity to take discoveries that the University of Oregon has always been great at making in terms of basic or fundamental research, and then figure out how to move those out so that they have a broader societal impact. And that's really the intent of everything that we're working on right now. So I just have a few slides. My hope is that I could just run through the slides, and then we'll answer any questions that you have. And for the record, I should start by saying that my name is Patrick Phillips, and I'm the acting executive director of the new science campus.
And hello, everyone. I'm Jim Hutchison. I'm a professor of chemistry and materials science at the University of Oregon. I also work as an associate vice president in the research office.
Hello, I'm Susan Cooper. I'm a graduate student at the University of Oregon, a PhD candidate in the chemistry department.
Excuse me, what department?
Chemistry.
Thanks.
Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. So so what we have, as I said, is a billion-dollar initiative. It's really unprecedented at a national scale, and the intent is to really fast-track these discoveries. And so it creates an infrastructure not only to do research, which is something that we're great at, but also do the development part, which is the more entrepreneurial activities, and to think about how we can spin out our discoveries into the wider world. And another goal is to really think about the University of Oregon's role within the state and how we can help create a stronger regional hub for discovery and innovation that is based not only in the South Willamette Valley, but then has tendrils that will strengthen the relationships across the state. So all of these things is a very external, outward-facing element to the university that we sometimes haven't always had, but we're very cognizant and really being focused on that as we engage in all of these things that we're talking about here. So the initial phase of this, which has been funded by a $500 million gift, which is unprecedented, again, at a national scale, is to build two 75,000-square-foot buildings. For those of you who know Eugene, it'll be on the north side of Franklin Boulevard, directly across from where most of our existing science buildings are. We'll equip them with state-of-the-art equipment and to create spaces that allow not only for cutting-edge research. Our overall plan over the 10-year period is to hire 30 new research faculty and their associated teams. There'll be, again, whenever all is said and done, 600 to 700 new researchers that would include staff and graduate students and postdocs on campus. And then a unique part of this is to create entrepreneurial spaces that will allow companies to spin out from the university, but also be available for companies who want to spin in and make use of those spaces. So in the ideal world, we'll be able to create new activities that are born out of the University of Oregon, but then also create such an attractive environment that people from other regions and outside the state will want to come and then start using Eugene and the rest of Oregon as a way of creating new business opportunities. I think we know that we have these behemoths, Seattle and the Bay Area, that we're sort of bookended by, and a lot of our businesses that start up want to move to those areas because of the infrastructure that they have. But there's cost to that because those are also very expensive places to do business. And so we have some great opportunities, I think, within Oregon to really think about what the future of the state is in terms of what kinds of economic activity we want, what kind of jobs we want. And so we are really dedicated to facilitating that. So overall, our mission of the campus is science advancing society. So everything that we do is coupling how research then has broader societal impacts, both in terms of economic impacts, but also things like policy and health advances. And the vision, again, is to dramatically shorten the timeline between discovery and the impact through research, training, and entrepreneurship in a really nimble environment. So why is this great? It really has a lot of benefits to the state. It creates this innovation hub, which we really need in this state. It enhances our national reputation. I've been going around the country to see how other groups have started these things up, and all eyes are on Oregon right now. They see this as a very unique opportunity, so it's a great opportunity for us to really raise the stature of the University of Oregon and the state as a whole in this space. And then it fuels this economic engine that is the new way of doing business in sort of this modern economic environment that I think that Oregon can become a leader on. More broadly, there are huge economic impacts. I'll go over some of the numbers in just a second, but this is an endeavor that pays dividends immediately and really pays for itself immediately. But a big part of what we're talking about, and you'll hear from Susan in a second, is really keeping Oregon discoveries for Oregonians, that is to keep them in Oregon. Right now we have an issue that we have a lot of smart people in Oregon. They do a lot of great stuff, but it's very hard for them to get started, and they frequently will move to the Bay Area or even Boston or something like that that has a lot more infrastructure to support these activities. So we think the next phase of really making Oregon work for itself is to create the infrastructure so these businesses and other activities can be kept within the state and really help fuel the state. Another important part of that, actually, is the training of our students. So we want to have the best possible training in these new areas for Oregon students. And so that's an opportunity for that. But beyond that, another thing that I've learned as I've gone around is that other areas are really starting to think about regional solutions. If you go to the Bay Area, it's not just Berkeley that's doing things. It's how is Berkeley working with Stanford and UC San Francisco to create integrative research environments. And so I think that that's really an important future for the state. And I've been talking to my colleagues at OHSU and OSU, and they agree that this is really something we need to start moving towards, is how do we start connecting our campuses and our research efforts to leverage the strengths that we have. So a great example of that is just 2 weeks ago, we hosted a research summit between researchers, 80 researchers from OHSU and the U of O. We all got together and thought about what is our future together as an institution. OHSU, obviously in med school, they're great at what they do, but they don't have chemistry or math or computer science. And at the U of O, we're strong in all of these fundamental sciences, but we don't have a medical school, so we don't have opportunities to sort of test some of those health impacts that we ordinarily would. So we're already starting on thinking about what this regional kind of approach can look like. So overall, we think that this is this economic driver, and that's great for this committee. Obviously, we're very interested in having a discussion with you about how you see the business environment. I think that there's an opportunity moving forward to continue our conversation and rethink the relationship between the state, universities, and local businesses to think about how we get all these activities catalyzed, and we're really looking forward to that. So what are the impacts? So during the construction phase, we're going to be generating $176 million in economic impact immediately. That's $11 million in new tax revenue. So this is really an effort that pays for itself right out of the gate. Over the long term, we have $79 million of prolonged economic impact, $7 million of additional tax revenue. And this is sort of a guaranteed minimum. Eco Northwest is the organization that helped us do these projections. And despite our efforts, they would not include any potential business activity that was generated. So this is just the impact of the salaries and the grant activity of the researchers that we'll be hiring. So on top of this will be any business-associated activity that spins out. So it's a really great opportunity. The other thing that I really like to emphasize in this is that this is a sustained activity. Unlike a lot of capital projects, we'll keep paying for the building because all the activities here will be sustained either through endowment, through the rest of the project, the funds that we're developing there, or through research funding activities that the organization does. So this creates no additional load on the state allocation to the university, no general funds, and no tuition load. So it's completely funded and self-contained. So no additional cost to the rest of the university operation. So it's completely independent and sustainable in perpetuity. So when we talk about these economic impacts, they're ongoing, hopefully forever. You know, we can talk about the research funding climate, but for now, it's we're in good shape. So what we're doing is really thinking about how to start this off on the strongest possible footing. We have to build the infrastructure of these buildings, and everything else that we do will be sort of layered on top of that infrastructure. So we're asking the state for $100 million in bonding authority, and then the university will be bringing $100 million of their own funds to this. So it's a one-to-one match, a 10-to-1 multiplier when you think about over the billion-dollar scale of the project. So it's really extraordinary. And as I said, it's anchored by this initial gift of $50 million a year, and that will help get all the operations going. So part of the challenge here, and I know that this is a challenging year for the state, is that we have to make decisions about the scale of the building that we're doing and everything up front. And what we're really looking to the state is to help partner so that we can fund all these external looking parts of the training program spaces, the economic activity spaces, the entrepreneurial activities. So it's a great opportunity for that. So I'll turn it over to my colleague Jim Hutchinson here, and he can talk about the vision for the Knight campus as it relates to basically how research and other activities fit together.
Thanks. So the graphic that you see is something that we developed in the process of planning the campus, and that's called the impact cycle. And if you look in the upper right-hand corner, it says inquiry. That's what we're really great at. You know, the universities traditionally have been fantastic at generating new knowledge, training the next generations of students. But in the absence of having an engineering school or a medical school, many of those basic science discoveries that could have impact on society just end up in a journal article someplace, and that's the end of the day. You just do the next research project, publish more, train more students, and so on. And many of us at the university want the university to be much more externally focused and think about how the work that we're doing could have immediate impact for society. How can we benefit society the most from our work? And so what we're creating through this process is this, like I said, the impact cycle where we do it, we discover something, we translate that to what society needs. That kind of innovation then leads to big impact, and that impact in turn fuels new ideas. It helps us uncover questions that we didn't even know we needed to ask that come up during the process of commercializing something. In addition to that, there's a whole, I'll talk a little bit more about this after a short video that we're going to see, talk a little bit more about how that impact then fuels new basic science research. It actually brings funding, brings partnerships that fuel that. So let's do this. I've always really been passionate about connecting my athletic life and my chemistry. As a chemist, I've always been really interested in the architectures of molecules. I actually think about molecules as, you know, these three-dimensional objects that are a little bit like buildings. The kinds of molecules that I study are nanoparticles. By tethering silver nanoparticles to the surface of clothing, we can actually make those anti-odor. It's pretty cool to then be able to take that technology in the lab, take it home, wash a shirt that had developed persistent odor, and be able to wear that shirt for multiple workouts in a row without any kind of odor building up in the shirt. It's really cool. It's always hard to watch yourself in these things. I noticed that I run a lot slower than when I was a high school athlete. So the basic discovery that we had that fueled all of this was just we were exploring the early days of nanotechnology 20 years ago. How do you make these small particles and what are they good for? And as we went through that, it turned out other people in the market were trying to place those on fabric to prevent persistent odor and polyester. And it works, except that their technologies immediately washed right off the clothing. So you pay money for it and then at the end of the day, you've lost all of that active ingredient right off the clothing. So it wasn't good for the product, wasn't good for the consumer, wasn't good for the environment. We knew how to attach particles to surfaces so they didn't come off. And so we said, hey, that's something that we could do. So in 2008, we launched a company. It's called Dune Sciences. I grew up in Florence. There's lots of sand dunes, so Dune Sciences seemed like a cool name. Nanoparticles are lots of particles, so that seemed really interesting. But in 2008 was a tough time to start a company, and it was slow going. And now we've got traction. A couple of our products are sitting here in front of me. They're now in Cabela's. They're in a variety of biking outlets all over the country. People love the product. We heard people talk today in our meetings about the fact they use it. I didn't tell them about it, so it's really gaining traction. The thing is, though, that it took a decade for that to happen. There were a number of business pivots that had to take place in order to make it happen, and that probably could have happened in 2 or 3 years with the new science campus. If you immerse scientists with people who really understand the market, who understand how to translate science into business, and then put around them the right resources and capital to do it, these things go a lot faster. We get a lot more benefit from the activities that happen in Oregon for Oregonians. And ultimately, it keeps the innovators here instead of having them, you know, end up needing to go to the Bay Area or Seattle or Boston to find the resources that they need. So it's been a great success, but it could have been faster and we could do it more regularly with the kinds of investment that we're talking about. And as an Oregonian, a longtime Oregonian, I think this is the sort of thing I'd like to see our university doing, is taking a lead on developing products that make Oregonians' lives better. I'd like to have here, we debated this, you know, much like it's Intel inside, we wanted Oregon inside, but figured that might lead to some kind of litigation, so we didn't do that. So as I said, for the future generations is a real opportunity, and Susan's here to speak to the student perspective on how a campus like this would create opportunities that would keep her and her colleagues here.
So I worked in the Bay Area before pursuing my graduate degree at a startup, and so my entire purpose of coming for a graduate degree was
Could you state your name, please?
Yes, I'm Susan Cooper. Sorry. It was to start a startup. And so I came to Oregon because we had a variety of different professors like Jim who had started companies and I wanted mentors and advisors who would be able to set me up with the resources I needed. I work on essentially iron oxide nanoparticles, which is nanorust, that could either be used to purify water or to be a treatment or cure for cancer or in cancer treatments. And so I would like to be able to start a company off of some of this research. But in the process of my degree, I tried to set out to find these programs and resources that I would need. And so I ended up starting some of those throughout my graduate career. But if those had already been in place, that would have been a really great thing for me in my trajectory. I just recently, this last week, went down to Cyclotron Road, which is a incubator in the Bay Area at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. And they have an amazing incubator where they have scientists that are a community of scientists that can really help them in their commercializing their products, as well as a team of business associates as well that can help them learn the skills they need. And so if we could have something like that in Oregon, it would make it so that students like me who have entrepreneurial aspirations, it would make the most sense to stay in Oregon instead of seeking out these resources in other areas of the country.
Thanks. So I just want to wrap this up so we can have time for questions. And just really to say that this is really a once-in-a-generation opportunity. We rarely have this level of economic investment to start something brand new, something that's responsive to university needs and very responsive to the state. So we're really looking forward to partnering with the state to make this happen. It's a great opportunity to capitalize on all the great things that and capacities that we have, but to really expand these and to turn our knowledge into real-life impacts that can really change the world, I think. So today's a great day to seize the moment, at least over the next 6 months, and really get this moving together. Thanks.
Well, it's a really exciting prospect to see that. I've studied this stuff a lot over the years in my former professional life and doing development work. It's kind of the way Stanford Research Park or the Research Triangle or a lot of stuff around Route 128 started. Happened, meaning that connection between that. I was impressed at the kickoff of this last fall, was it? Dr. Robinson from OSHU talking about he's seen this as the piece that was missing from OSHU's night research. He's saying we have the research side, but we need those ideas, a place to help turn it into business, and they don't do that there. And he thought the U of O would be a natural alignment. I've heard Dr. Ray say the same thing from OSU, that there's a natural complication. You guys are naturally U of O focused, but I think this does have a statewide potential for that. And really, from a legislative perspective, to me, this is an opportunity to get a return on the investment for the state and the dollars that we put into the university. You know, obviously, our first focus is on the students from our perspective, but I think the fact that we are losing, I've watched this, we've lost a lot of ideas coming out of the universities, and I use that plurally, going to Seattle or down to California, the Bay Area, or down to San Diego, and some of the wet lab applications we just don't have. This is very cool to see this opportunity. I think you're right. I think it's unique chance to do that, and listening to the young scientists when we talked about the RAIN project a few years ago and started that, I was surprised at how many of the young scientists like you that were talking about wanting to do that. I will tell you, that's a very different experience than when I was working with universities in the late 80s and early 90s. So you have a different perspective on life than your older colleagues had. Other questions? Senator?
A few, if I may. A few questions, if I may.
A few questions, sure.
So I wanted to start out with what's your timeline for having this complete?
Chair Beyer and Senator Riley, thank you for Senator Beyer's comments, which I appreciate. And it's not U of O focused. We actually are thinking about the wider world. And we're being very aggressive, actually, I think unprecedentedly aggressive. So we've already engaged architects and builders. We're in the planning process. We're hoping to officially break ground in September, so obviously we're quite anxious to hear about what the overall level of financial investment can be. It's a three-year building project, which sounds like a long time, but actually that's very, very fast. Most university projects take 5 to 10 years, and so we're At the outset, we said we wanted, it's accelerating. It's in the title. So we want all aspects of it. And we built a very aggressive project. We only hired architects and builders who would agree that they could meet that. And so far, we're right on schedule through our design and planning process. And so that's basically what we're looking for. We're hoping to open our doors in January of 2020 and have the researchers basically arrive and move in at that moment. The overall project is a 10-year project to hire everyone and to build out the entire process.
Okay, so I noticed that Phil Knight's gift is $50 million a year for 10 years.
That's correct.
So that's half of what you need over that period. Have you started a donor search for more donors for this project already?
Yeah, so we already have a number of donors who are quite committed to the sciences and interested in it. Our initial focus is just really getting this launched and successful. I think what we know is that donors have our eyes on us to prove that we can do this, which we can, I'm confident. And quite frankly, they also have their eyes on the state to see what it means to really try and do something world-class, not just good for Oregon, but at an international level, doing something different. And most of those efforts, you know, are large, and they involve some level of state investment. So we're quite confident that we'll reach our overall goal. If we will be successful no matter what we do, because we're being very conservative in our fiscal planning. We're not doing anything that we can't afford at each stage of the game. So we're building the buildings that we can afford now. The next phase would be to build more buildings as more money comes in. But we won't be asking the state for more money beyond this. So this is really to help us get the thing started at a strong level.
I guess two's enough. Thank you.
Just two?
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else? Oh, yeah. Senator Thompson?
Yeah. They asked for the state's $100 million?
That's correct.
Because I thought it was like $170 million. Was it higher than this, or has it always just been $100
million? That's the payback.
Huh?
That's the payback.
That's the debt. $100 million in bonds.
$100 million in bonds. Oh, the payback's 170. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you didn't mention anything about, like, square footage costs. Do you have any of those kind of figures at this time?
Yes.
I was just curious.
Chair Beyer and Vice Chair Thompson. We do have estimates on that. One of the unique aspects of this project to really accelerate it is that our architects we have builders in our construction company is in every meeting with our architects as we're planning. So we have an iterative cycle of what costing is as we're doing design so we can make sure. So the $200 million is the total project cost, which involves property acquisition and design and all of those kinds of things. The actual construction costs are probably going to be a little less than $700 a square foot, which we've looked at. That's a lot for a house, but for a high-end research building, we've looked at a national scale, adjusting for costs. It's actually a little bit below what recent buildings, say, at the University of Washington have been built. So both our architects and our construction people have a lot of experience in building these kinds of facilities. So we're pretty much right on target right now with our cost.
One more follow-up. So, like, that's for the building. Is part of this, you're going to have lots of different kind of equipment to make the building function. Is that part of this, or will that be added on later?
Yes, Senator Thompson, the capitalized equipment is included in the cost. So very large scale scientific equipment that's sort of technically part of the building in terms of the overall ongoing research operations are part of the $200 million. That would be paid for with the university contribution as part of our match. And so this bonding authority would be for the largely for the capital. The university would be paying a large fraction of the capital in addition, and then also paying for other site improvements and equipment and those kinds of things.
So I assume this contains a lot of wet lab space?
It contains quite a bit of wet lab space, yes.
So a whole lot of air handling and piping, exotic piping.
Yes, the costs are of building these kinds of things are. We're working with Hoffman Construction, who has built a number of the Intel facilities in the state recently, and they're really expert at running a lot of high-end pipe around to keep equipment cool and fed with power and those kinds of things. So we have a great team.
Pretty similar to a hospital construction.
It's probably somewhere a mix between a hospital and a high-end manufacturing facility, something like that. Not that I'm expert in such things, but yes.
You just use them. Other questions? Senator Wright.
I do have another one. So typically we do bonding for the university system when all the universities get together and say, here's our high priorities, and I understand this one didn't go through that process. And I'm just curious why we don't put this in with all the other bonding that we do for universities.
Senator Riley, I'm happy to respond to that. There's multiple layers to that answer. The first one is I just want to be clear that the university 100% supports the overall bonding package, that is the priorities that are defined by the universities that has agreed through the HEC. So we don't ever want this to be viewed as a trade-off on any other. That is definitely the top priority. We, because of the timing of this activity, we went to the governor and asked her how we should approach it. We talked about going outside the normal bounds because we had sort of missed the window because of when the gift came in. She recommended to us and asked us to go through the HEC, and so they did actually score it and then rank it as part of their overall bond. So it is part of the bond package in that respect, that it's part of it. But it is outside of what the previously agreed to sort of bond limit was. And why do we do that? Well, we do think it's an extraordinary opportunity. It is not going to come around again, and the timing of things are such that it's really an opportunity to take advantage of a one-time deal. We can only build these buildings once. They're 100-year buildings, and so we want to make sure we're building the building that's going to support the activities that we're really dreaming about to help the state and help our students.
Go ahead.
Just curious, will it serve undergrads, graduate students, doctorates, all of the above?
Senator Thompson, it'll serve all of the above. So the initial focus will be on graduate programs. And I don't know what our timing is, but I would love to have Dr. Hutchinson talk about the internship program that he helped form. It's completely innovative and tremendous. So it'll be supporting those kinds of activities. There'll be undergraduate activities supported through entrepreneurship and research. We're just in the early phases because this takes a more formal planning process about degrees and those kinds of things to really think about what the undergraduate program is going to look like. And we're hiring 30 faculty, and we really want those faculty to come and help us design what the future of the university is going to look like. And so the timing of that is probably for the next phase of building that we'll be funding more directly.
Patrick, let me make sure that I'm clear on this, because I think I am, but these buildings, the intent of this campus is to transfer research from the university to the private world. That's what's unique about this, is this is really focused on private side activities, transferring that knowledge and creating opportunities. Is that correct?
That's correct, Chairman Beyer. So that'll have two aspects of it. One is it will create new research space for faculty and researchers. Those faculty and researchers will be new to the university. They'll be endowed. There'll be different kinds of people than we've traditionally had and hired at the university that will be more externally focused. So that's, but they will be university employees. They won't be in a business per se, but they will have that as part of their portfolio. The other part of that is we will build space for companies to hire, to rent, so that companies that are spinning out can make use of the research facilities that we're building. And the new model is, and again, Susan can speak more to this, is we used to like set aside a room or a couple of rooms for some company to rent. Say the Stanford model would be, it's a great model, but it's down on a different part of the campus. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This is inside. This is, and so we can rent basically a lab bench by the foot. So if you're a single undergrad and you have a great new discovery and you want to start a business and you need access to all this equipment, you can rent a single little bench space and do your company right there. And so the scalability, and part of the reason why is because the you know, the young people today, they have this social networking aspect of things. So if you're starting a company as a single individual, you actually want to be in an environment where you know something. Someone next door, just in the bench next to you, knows something else. You can get together, talk, do business development, do networking, those kinds of things. So that's the kind of exciting opportunities. And that actually is pretty unique on a national scale. That's a new model that people really haven't pursued. The business park model has been around for a long time. This is something different.
Well, I guess the other uniqueness is you're bringing into it, as I understand it, the business school and the law school to provide that back piece to the scientists when trying to roll out and start a company.
Jim, would you like to talk about the entrepreneurial activity?
Sure. Yeah, Chair Beyer, I think that's a great part of this is the way in which we intend to make this an interdisciplinary campus. You know, that's been one of our hallmarks as an institution for the last 60 years, is the way that we bring disciplines together. I think one thing that's going to be unique in this case is many entrepreneurial programs around the country are somewhat bolt on at the end of, you know, somebody has a discovery and they try to get it all the way to commercialization, and then at some late stage you bring in the business school and law students to help. Those are a lot of the business part is focused on the business students and the law students, but not so much on the scientists. So one of the things with this campus we're going to do is to make we're going to lead with science entrepreneurs. So we're going to put more responsibility on all of our scientists to do this activity, and then we're going to integrate the business and law to help assist that, but we're not going to hand it over. We're not going to throw it over the transom. We're going to try to train scientists so that they will be wanting to take that all the way through, and they'll recruit the help they need along the way. And we think that's going to be a really important and differentiating model, because it's scientist first. You know, scientist is innovator, and we're going to have 500 plus people all innovating. Some of them are going to be black belts at it. Some may be green belts, but we're going to have a much larger number of people, all with a focus on impact and innovation. I think that's going to make a big difference on this campus, and it will then connect with the business and law and external entrepreneurs as needed along the way to accelerate that process.
Anybody else? Well, thank you very much. Exciting concept.
Thank you all for your time. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
All righty, so we will end that information session, and I think we're going to go 2403 next, right?
Yeah, that's great.
So we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2403.
All right, Mr. Chair.
I don't think it'd make any difference.
Members of the committee, House Bill 2403 requires drivers that are involved in an automobile accident to exchange the names of their respective insurance carriers and the applicable policy numbers associated with the vehicles involved in the accident. This measure comes to us on a House floor vote of 57-0. There is no amendments, minimal fiscal impact, and no revenue impact, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lively is here to speak to the bill.
Representative, welcome to our committee. Your first time here.
Well, it's nice to be here, I hope.
Or you wait.
Wait a minute. Well, about 5 minutes, you can decide. Once a year, this committee.
Well, this is. We need
to rule. Do you want to speak on this one, too?
No, you're okay.
You have no support from DMV.
No, I know.
I'll try it without them.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is John Lively. I represent House District 12, which happens to be half of Senator Byer's Senate district. I am pleased to be here today to speak about House Bill 2403. I'm going to share an incident with you, and while the incident isn't the reason for this bill, because it happened after I'd introduced the bill, it just reinforces why this bill is important. On December 22nd, I was driving west on Main Street in Springfield, stopped at a red light at 14th and Main, and smack, somebody going 30 miles an hour hit the back of my car and threw me out into the middle of the intersection. Fortunately, nobody was going across the intersection when I went out there. My initial reaction was not a very positive one, but when I got out of my truck and walked back, now we're in the middle of the intersection, a young person stepped out of this truck and was very apologetic and didn't know. She said her brakes failed. I won't participate in what might have happened, but nonetheless, she didn't see me stopped. Once we got out of the street into a parking lot, we instantly exchanged our insurance information, our registration information, everything. She was very willing and provided information, and in fact, followed up later because her insurance was expiring. Now, that worked the way most of us assume it should work in an accident, but that's not the way it always works. Historically, the police, in many cases, used to respond to all accidents, even non-injury accidents. They don't anymore. It's for the people to figure out themselves. And what it turns out is there's nothing in our law that requires people to share insurance information. They need to share their driver's license, a vehicle registration, but nothing requires they don't have to share their insurance information. So if you're in an accident and you're trying to work out this thing, if you don't have that information, it makes it very difficult for the parties to do that. I can tell you my youngest daughter works in a 911 center, and many calls they receive are because of accidents like this, and when they go through and tell the people, because often the people ask, so what can I get from the other person? They read the law, and one of the things isn't in the law was that they have to require proof of insurance or what the insurance information does. So all this bill simply does is adds to our law that part of requirement is not only to furnish your registration and your driver's license, but insurance information if you're involved in an accident, so both parties have the information that they would need in order to resolve the dispute. That's all it does.
That's it.
That's it.
Senator Thompson, did you have a question?
You got thrown from your vehicle?
No, I didn't get thrown. My vehicle got thrown out
in
the intersection.
From your vehicle, okay.
No.
Sounded like, wow, that was nasty. Okay.
I'm a tough guy, but not that.
Okay.
Thank you. Senator, it's nice to hear from somebody so rational from that area.
Thank you, Senator Gerard. I appreciate that.
It's always very pleasant on this side of the building.
I could tell.
And if we could just have such rational people from the other districts, that'd be great.
I'll come over here more often. This is better than some of mine. So.
Well, you know, the farther north you go, the more trouble you have. All right. Anything else for John? For Senator Lively? Amy, you're okay with this? Amy's good.
Okay.
If Amy's good, everything's fine.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Is there anybody else who wishes to talk about HB 2403? Seeing none, we will close public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2403. Senator.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2403 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
The senator has moved House Bill 2403 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? It's done.
I'll carry it.
And Senator Gerard will carry it. See, we do things a little quicker on this side.
Yeah, you don't have to wait 3 weeks.
Which one do I want to go to? If we want to do this one, I will call Senator Johnson.
Okay. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2922. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2922 increases the surcharge collected for the issuance of Crater Lake National Park registration plates from $10 per plate to $15 per plate. That would mean, Mr. Chair, that upon purchasing plates, it would be increased cost of $20 to $30. It's a one-time cost, Mr. Chair. The measure has a minimal fiscal impact, minimal revenue impact. The House vote was 52 to 4, Mr. Chair, and there's no amendments.
All righty. Well, Representative Esquivel would have liked to have been here, but he injured his back, and he gave me something he wanted me to read, so I'm just going to do that. He says, one, Crater Lake license plates have been issued since the 100th anniversary of Crater Lake National Park in 2002. Over 250,000 sets of plates have been sold, helping to create an endowment at the Oregon Community Foundation to support education and science research at the park. They continue to sell over 1,200 sets of plates per month. Currently, it is the least expensive custom plate and offered as a one-time surcharge. The additional cost for these custom plates add an administrative charge of $4.18 per set, are levied by the Oregon DMV, and subject to any increased cost over time. The legislature sets the selling price for the plates. Three, increasing the one-time surcharge from $20 to $30 per set offers Oregonians an inexpensive way of supporting programs and projects at Crater Lake and have plates that show off Oregon's natural icon with white contrasting numbers. It will remain the least expensive custom plate. Four, most importantly, the additional funds added to the endowment will help to support for the proposed Crater Lake Rim Village Information and Education Center that will help leave a lasting impression on many of the 750,000 visitors to Oregon's only national park. And the proposed Rim Village Information and Education Center will cost between $8 and $9 million with ongoing operational costs of $50,000 to $100,000. The license plate endowment will help both in construction and ongoing costs. The National Park Service federal support will be in the range of $6 to $8 million. There you go. So saith Representative Esquivel. And with that, Amy.
Chair Byron, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation on House Bill 2922. Representative Esquivel did a nice job summarizing what the bill will do. Very simply, a set of plates will rise from $20 a set to $30 a set under this bill. It's a one-time fee. Really an incredibly successful plate. Crater Lake is just some interesting items over the life of the plate. Over $5 million has been transferred to the Crater Lake Fund in 2016 alone, almost $250,000. Projected increase under the bill in the first full biennium when this would be in effect, the 24 months, $336,000 or so additional dollars to that cause. So really, that's about it. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them on this bill.
Okay. Questions?
This doesn't have anything to do with billboards, does it?
Chair Byron, Senator Thompson, no, but since the committee's so receptive to my discussions
from
the chair's earlier statement, I'd welcome the ability to tackle that one again. And here we are in Crater Lake.
So that would be a different bill, Amy.
I do have one little question. I do have one serious question.
Serious question?
So this will still be one of the cheapest plates, even though we're losing the fee?
Yeah, Chair Byron, Senator Thompson. Right, for special plates, particularly because it's a one-time-only fee. You don't have to keep paying at renewal, which most of the other plates are. Pacific Wonderland, by comparison, also a one-time plate, but it's $100 for that one. So it really is. I think the bicycle plate also is pretty inexpensive and a one-time fee, but it would be on the order of this. But it may still be, Crater would perhaps still be the cheapest plate.
Okay, and I'll probably be in support. It's probably the first Sal, Representative Esquivel's probably never even voted for a fee increase, and he's actually got his name on a bill to increase a fee, so I'll be a yes.
All right. Anything else? We'll remind him of that. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who would like to testify on House Bill 2922? Seeing none, we'll close public hearing. We'll open work session on House Bill 2922.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2922 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Thompson has moved House Bill 2922 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion.
No
look like you want to say something. No? You neither?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Is anybody... Is there any opposition to the motion? There is none. It's passed, and Senator Thompson would like to carry that. So we'll close on that, and we'll open on House Bill 2149.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2149 specifies that persons who qualify as former prisoners of war may pay a one-time $15 fee to register a motor vehicle. There is a fiscal impact statement that was issued with this measure. It's available on OLIS. There's also a minimal revenue impact. The measure came out of the House with a vote of 60-0, Mr. Chair. And Representative Johnson's here.
Representative Johnson, welcome.
Well, welcome, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm Mark Johnson from House District 52. Thanks for hearing this bill today. I'm bringing this bill to you on behalf of constituent by the name of Alfred Gilbert. He's a resident of Gresham. He's actually also a constituent of Senator Thompson, unbeknownst to him, so he's going to learn something today. Alfred is a former, he's a World War II vet, and he's a former POW. He was actually on the front lines during the landing on the beaches of Normandy. And 3 days after the initial D-Day invasion, he and several other members of his company were captured by a German tank division, not long after they just moved in from the beaches. He was held prisoner for 11 months, being moved between Stalags multiple times, enduring hunger and all kinds of deplorable conditions, as you can imagine. He and his fellow prisoners finally escaped when their German guards abandoned the Stalag during the bombing of Dresden near the end of the war. They walked then towards Czechoslovakia until they encountered Russian forces and were finally returned to Allied territory after that. Alfred was honorably discharged from the U.S. Army on November 29th of 1945. He and his family later moved to Oregon, and he worked in a paper mill industry for 40 years before he retired. This last summer, Alfred tried to get his ex-POW registration and license plates renewed. He's 96 years old, by the way. Keep that in mind. He and his son, Keith Moore, who's with me today, went to the local DMV in Sandy to apply for the registration and plates. Keith is a veteran also, and he knew that disabled veteran plates required just a one-time fee, and he thought that the POW plates would be the same. However, Alfred and Keith learned that they would have to pay for the plates, pay for the registration renewal, pay for registration fee to Multnomah County, costing a total of $153 that day, and then, of course, there'd be more fees down the road. You see, there's a difference between disabled veteran plates and ex-POW plates. Disabled veterans plates are permanent. They're not subject to Multnomah County's registration fee, and they have a one-time total cost of $44. Ex-POW plates currently have to be renewed every 2 years. They are subject to Multnomah County's registration fee. They cost $153 and require an additional $86 every time they need to be renewed. So at this point of this bill, House Bill 2149 would simply allow former POWs to pay a one-time fee for their plates, the same as disabled vet plates currently require. Establishes a one-time registration fee of $15. And again, it has the same language in here that exists for disabled veterans plates. So it's not just Alfred we are doing this for, however, I need to make that point. In September this year, there were 33 current former ex-POW plates in Oregon. And 92 plates that were no longer valid for various reasons, as we might imagine. So with that, I'll let you hear from a son-in-law of this American hero. As you can imagine, we're talking about somebody here who, you know, you all have seen the movie Saving Private Ryan. You know, think about D-Day and those folks that were moving inland, and that's exactly what Alfred did. But and very, very, and I think, do we have him on the phone?
I will be calling.
In a moment, okay. But I'll let his son here go ahead and fill in the gaps on this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hello, my name is Keith Moore. I am the son-in-law of Alfred Gilbert, and I want to thank the Senator Beyer and the chair people for allowing me to speak before you today. I'll kind of paraphrase what I have pre-written, but on behalf of the family of Alfred, what we call Al Gilbert, our father, would like to take this opportunity to express our gratitude to the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation, as well as Senator Mark Johnson for introducing House Bill 2149. This would be revising the Oregon state statute in providing a one-time decreased vehicle registration fee for the former prisoner of war. We are humbled that we are taking this opportunity for us and for you, rather, to listen and review the documents that are supporting this on our father's behalf. I'm here before you on then given the support of House Bill 2149, we are very much in agreement that the revision of the Oregon State statute is a long overdue, and to the servicemen and women of the United States Armed Forces and found themselves as POWs during war or military conflicts. We would like to take, like our father and our other POWs, past and future, to be recognized for their sacrifices they endured during the time they were POWs, by the state of Oregon and its governing body recognizing these POW veterans have a one-time decreased registration fee of their vehicle registered in the state of Oregon with a permanent ex-POW registration and plates. We, the family, as well as Alfred Gilbert, greatly appreciate the work and time that has been put in so far in House Bill 2149. And in closing, I would like to thank Senator Lee Beyer, Chair Lee Beyer, and the rest of the Senate committee on allowing me and my father-in-law's behalf to speak in regards to House Bill 2149.
Thank you. Any questions? So should we call Mr. Gilbert?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I would mention that, he was able to come down for the floor vote, sat on the side aisle, but he gets out more infrequently.
Hello, Mr. Gilbert.
Yes.
This is Senator Lee Beyer, the chair of the Senate Business and Transportation Committee. We're considering House Bill 2149 that would allow you to buy prisoner war plates for a one-time fee. So I want to give you a chance to comment. I understand you came down for the House hearing, but didn't want to make that trip again for the Senate.
Well, I would have liked to make the trip, but I just don't feel like it. I was in the hospital for a couple of weeks for the heart attack.
And, oh, my.
Getting over it. Anyhow, Chairman Beyer, the members of the committee, this started last year in July. My car needed new license plates, and I went down and ran it through, and it passed all right for emission, and but I did not get my license there. I generally do. We have been talking about the permanent license and the POW license plate. So my son the next day brought me up to Sandy, Oregon. And we went early. They were still six or eight ahead of us. And when they opened the door, everybody took a ticket and we went in with a number. We sat there, and when my name came up, we walked up to the lady that was in one of the service spots and asked about this, and she said, oh dear, I've never made out one for a POW. So she got calling and asking some of the other people that worked there some questions, and we filled out some papers and signed them, and when it all boiled down to, she said that is a special plate, and it will be changed every 2 years, and the price is $153. Well, that is not what we understood. We thought we were going up a one-time payment, and that was it. But that isn't the way the thing read up there. Anyhow, I paid the money. I didn't want to go back up. My son-in-law was with me, and he wanted to take me back home and show them that I was a disabled veteran and had service connections with the VA. And I said, no, I'll pay the fee. So I did get my plate, but my son-in-law Keith got that started, and he called down there and wrote down there, and it ended up that I was down at that one meeting with the House, and it's gone to the Senate now, and I understand if it passes, it will go to the governor. So there's not much more I can say about it, only that we were looking for 100% disability and getting a plate on the car. That would be a one-time deal, and it might cost that much. So right now we're waiting to see what happens. Everybody has been more than helpful and done a lot of work on this, and I'm thankful for that, whichever way it goes.
Well, Mr. Gilbert, thank you for bringing this to our attention. Obviously, we weren't aware of the omission, if you will. And your son-in-law is a very persuasive fella, so I think we'll take care of that here in just a couple of minutes.
Okay, that sounds very good. And I do want to thank everybody that's been connected with this, because everyone has been more than helpful.
Well, thank you very much for your service to your country.
Thank you.
All righty. We'll let you get back to your business.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye.
Any other questions, group?
I don't see any. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
I would just add, just quite briefly, you know, it really was kind of a fascinating step back through kind of historical records. I don't know whether you have them or not, but we actually have copies of the original cables that his wife received, first notifying her that he was actually in a POW camp, but it was 5 weeks after he was captured. I mean, think about the lag. You know, communication is obviously a different thing.
Yeah.
And then finally, when they found out exactly what camp he was in, you know, where she could potentially connect with him via the Red Cross and stuff. But, you know, these are some pretty traumatic times, you know, and obviously it's not just World War II POWs. I'm sure there'd be some Vietnam POWs that could benefit from
and
this.
And they didn't
well.
Even have the internet then.
Exactly. The coconut wireless didn't work very well.
Senator Riley.
Yeah, I just was curious about if anybody knows how many former POWs we actually have in Oregon.
Is it 33? My understanding was the number that my staff had was there 33 current ex-POW plates in Oregon.
Yeah.
I don't know about the numbers, and there were 92 plates that were no longer valid for one reason or the other.
Yeah.
So
okay.
I don't know the full answer to that, Senator.
Small amount.
Yeah,
no, it's huge.
Yeah, I think it's a fairly small amount.
Thank you very much.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Amy?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. Just to indicate that you'll notice this bill did not go down to Ways and Means. We worked very hard to figure out a way to get the fiscal on this bill down very low. At first we were looking at doing a completely manual process, but we figured out a way to make this work, very happy to be able to assist in any way that we can to make this work.
Yeah. So my perception is it's a relatively small number, and certainly they deserve it.
Without a doubt. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Amy. Any questions of Amy? Seeing none. Did you want to testify? Okay. So we will close public hearing on House Bill 2149. Open a work session, excuse me. Senator?
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2149 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thompson has moved House Bill 2149 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on that motion? Is there any opposition to that motion? Senator Riley, did you want to carry it? Did you
yep.
want it?
My constituent.
It's his constituent.
Oh,
you
oh,
guys
well,
want you want to
okay?
share it?
Yeah, I don't care. You can have
yeah,
it.
You guys work it out. Senator Riley and Senator Thompson will carry, and one will close and one will open.
Perfect.
So we are closed on that, and I think that takes us to the end today, Patrick.
It does, Mr. Chair.
We're done. We're adjourned.